Welcome to the debate. So I want you to imagine for a moment that you are a pilot. You're flying a commercial airliner at, say, 30,000 feet. Usually, when we think about a catastrophic crisis in a complex system like that, we assume the danger comes from a lack of information, right?
Right, yeah. Like the radar goes completely blind or the fuel gauge breaks.
Exactly. You are suddenly flying in the dark, just sort of guessing where the mountains are.
It is the classic assumption, really, that ignorance is the primary threat. The problem is always what you cannot see.
Right. But I want you to imagine a completely different and honestly much more terrifying scenario. Imagine the cockpit is entirely flooded with data. Every single light on the dashboard is flashing.
Oh, like a total system overload?
Yeah. Every auditory alarm is blaring. The screens are displaying thousands of perfectly accurate real-time data points about the plane's aerodynamics, the cabin humidity, the coffee maker's temperature in the galley.
So the pilot is not starved for information at all?
Not at all. The pilot is completely paralyzed because the system can no longer distinguish between, say, a minor drop in cabin temperature and a total engine failure.
Right. It's a complete collapse of prioritization. The noise is so loud that the trivial things feel just as urgent and demand just as much attention as the things that actually keep the plane in the sky.
And that paralyzed pilot is us. That is the exact diagnosis of modern society presented in the 2026 white paper by Dr. Bashar Sayeli titled Toward Life Coherence Wisdom.
No, we aren't suffering from a lack of innovation, and we certainly aren't starved for data.
Right. We are suffering from a crisis of what the text calls misrelevance. Modern institutions are incredibly skilled at generating signals, but we have organized our attention, our metrics, and our ultimate concerns around things that do not actually protect or expand what the paper terms life capacity.
And we should probably define life capacity clearly before we go further, just because it grounds everything we are going to discuss today.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, the paper defines it as the real, tangible capacities of persons, communities, ecosystems, and future generations to live, heal, repair, and flourish.
Right.
So it is not an abstract metric. It is the literal breath in your lungs and the resilience of your community.
Exactly. So the central question we are debating today is this. How do we actually overcome this crisis of misrelevance? My position is that overcoming misrelevance fundamentally requires a structural and cognitive reorganization.
Of course you would take the structural side.
Well, it is the only one that makes sense at scale. We have to apply strict evaluative guardrails to aggressively de-implement lifeline systems. I mean, if we do not fix the structural architecture of our metrics and our institutions, no amount of good intention or emotional intelligence is going to save us.
And my position is that true life coherence wisdom must be primarily rooted in embodied emotional sentience and relational attunement.
Which sounds lovely, but...
Let me finish. If you try to build structural guardrails without first grounding them in our biological and emotional reality, those very guardrails simply become a new form of what the paper calls sacred capture. You end up building a beautiful new cage, but, you know, it is still a cage.
Okay, well, let me lay out the foundation for why the cognitive structural approach is the only viable path forward. Wisdom isn't just a subjective warm feeling. It has to be a self-correcting cognitive process. I draw heavily here on cognitive scientist John Vervaeke's concept of relevance realization, which the white paper places right at the core of its framework.
That's a heavy term. Break down what that actually means in practice.
Think of relevance realization like, well, the world's most sophisticated biological spam filter. Every single second, millions of data points hit your retinas, your eardrums, and your nervous system.
Right. A complete sensory overload.
Exactly. If you consciously processed all of it, you would literally go insane. So your cognition automatically filters out the noise. It determines what is salient, like what actually matters to your survival or your goals right now, and it transforms that salient information into insight.
It's the mechanism that turns an overwhelming, chaotic environment into a defined, solvable problem.
Yes, but relevance realization alone isn't enough, because it can be, and constantly is, hijacked by power, profit, or institutional self-preservation. That is why misrelevance is fundamentally a systemic failure.
Right.
We see this in what the vapor calls metric capture, where a measurable indicator is substituted for actual life, or institutional capture, where an organization's primary goal becomes protecting its own reputation rather than protecting the vulnerable people it was built to serve. Because the failure is structural, the solution must be structural.
I come at it from a different way. You are starting at the level of the dashboard, but you are ignoring the pilot. Wisdom cannot begin as a top-down structural test.
Why not?
Because before you can cognitively evaluate a metric or apply a theoretical guardrail, you are already a living, breathing organism embedded in a world. I anchor my perspective in the work of Catherine Pyle Kaufman, which the text highlights beautifully. She argues that emotion is not some irrational residue that clouds our pristine logical judgment. Emotion is viability sensing.
Viability sensing, meaning the body's ability to sense whether an environment supports its life or threatens it.
Precisely. It is a primordial form of biological intelligence. Long before your cognition can neatly frame a problem and run it through a spam filter, your nervous system is registering danger, loss, overload, or repair.
Okay, I see where you're going.
Yeah. If you walk into a highly toxic workplace, you feel the knot in your stomach and the tension in your jaw days or weeks before your brain can articulate exactly why the institutional structure is failing.
That is an interesting point, though I would frame it differently. Feelings can be incredibly misleading. They can be distorted by past trauma, by prejudice, or just by temporary exhaustion.
Sure, they can be.
I mean, you can feel threatened by something that is actually deeply beneficial, like a challenging new idea or a necessary systemic change.
They can be distorted, yes, but they remain the primary way life registers significance. You have to pair Pyle Kaufman's viability sensing with the biologist Humberto Maturana's concept of emotioning.
Wait, slow down. I know it is in the text, but emotioning sounds like a made-up word. What does that actually look like in a real human context?
It sounds strange because we usually think of emotions as nouns, right? Things we have. Maturana uses it as a verb because emotions are dynamic states that open up specific relational worlds. They dictate what actions are possible.
Okay. Give me an example.
Love, in his biological sense, opens a domain of legitimate coexistence where you can actually see another person as a legitimate other, not just an object. Fear, on the other hand, opens a world of threat and self-preservation. My argument is that if we start with your cognitive guardrails and institutional dismantling without first resting in the organism's lived emotional experience, we fall into the trap of spiritual bypass.
Using high-minded ideals to avoid dealing with messy reality.
Exactly. We fall into sacred abstraction. We end up solving problems on a spreadsheet. We pass new, highly logical policies while leaving actual human bodies in a state of terror or exhaustion.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. Let's look at where misrelevance does its most profound, undeniable damage in our society. I argue that metric capture is the primary driver of modern misrelevance, and it operates entirely independent of how people feel.
Independent? I doubt that.
Let's take the clinical example provided in the white paper, because I think it makes this incredibly concrete. You have a hospital. Over time, the hospital's management starts prioritizing bed turnover and throughput metrics over actual healing completion.
Well, because an empty bed is a measurable data point, whereas complete healing is complex and difficult to quantify.
Right. So a patient recovering from major surgery is discharged early because the dashboard says their approved length of stay has hit the maximum limit. The system completely ignores whether that patient actually has the resources, the family support, or the physical margins at home to recover.
It is the classic displacement of burden. The hospital's efficiency metric improves on paper, but the actual life capacity of the patient severely declines. The sickness doesn't go away, it just gets pushed onto a family that has no medical training.
And here is the crucial point. No amount of emotional attunement by the individual doctor changes that outcome if the metric dictates the discharge. Structural metrics are the load-bearing walls of society.
But the walls are built by people.
Yes, but if you place a load-bearing wall in the wrong spot, the entire building collapses, regardless of how empathetic the people inside the building are. A doctor might feel deep compassion. They might have perfect viability sensing and know the patient isn't ready.
Right.
But if the structural rule forces the patient out the door, the harm occurs anyway. This is why the white paper gives us three vital cognitive guardrails that we must forcibly apply to these systems.
You're talking about the life value, anti-violence, and discernment tests?
Yes. First, John McMurtry's life value test. We have to look at the hospital dashboard and ask, does this system expand or reduce life capacity? Second, Johann Galting's anti-violence test. We have to ask, what structural harm is this efficiency metric hiding?
And the third?
The discernment test. What is being made ultimate here? In this hospital, throughput is being made ultimate, while human life is treated as a secondary byproduct. We have to force these structural tests onto our institutions to change the load-bearing walls.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. You are treating metric capture as the root cause of the hospital's failure. But the paper makes it explicitly clear that metric capture is merely a symptom of underlying effective capture.
You're saying the metric is just a manifestation of an emotional state?
Think about it. Why does the hospital prioritize throughput in the first place? It is not because a computer randomly fell from the sky and handed the administrators a dashboard. It's because the institution is operating in a very specific emotional domain. Usually, that domain is financial terror.
Right.
It is fear of funding loss, fear of reputational damage, fear of litigation from shareholders.
The institution is trapped in survival mode.
Yes. And this goes back to Maturana's point. This emotional state of fear brings forth a specific world of action. If an institution lives in the emotional domain of fear, it will always view patients as liabilities and beds as assets.
But you still have to change the rules.
You could forcibly smash that throughput dashboard today using your life value test, and I guarantee you that tomorrow the terrified administrators will build a new metric that displaces the burden in a slightly different way. You cannot fix a hospital's obsession with efficiency without addressing the institutional shame, the exhaustion of the staff, and the financial terror driving it.
Well,
if you don't change the underlying effective world, your three cognitive guardrails just become a new bureaucratic checklist for middle managers to fill out of fear.
I am not convinced by that line of reasoning because you are assuming that changing the emotional state is a prerequisite for changing behavior. Often the mechanism of harm is so deeply embedded in procedure that the mechanics of repair must be purely structural.
Structure alone doesn't heal, though.
But it stops the bleeding. This brings us to one of the most powerful mandates in the white paper, the concept of de-implementation. We suffer from a civilizational addiction to addition.
Oh, absolutely. We try to solve complex problems by piling more complexity on top of them.
Exactly. If you're listening to this on your commute right now, think about your own office or organization. When management realizes that the staff is completely burning out, what do? They don't reduce your workload. They don't eliminate unnecessary reporting.
No, they add a mandatory one-hour wellness seminar to your calendar.
Right. They add a mindfulness app subscription while leaving the grueling 80-hour work week entirely intact. They add a diversity statement to the website instead of ripping out the exclusionary hiring practices. The paper argues that true repair requires subtraction. We have to aggressively dismantle and de-implement harmful procedures.
Which I agree with, in theory.
But this is where I push back very strongly on your reliance on relational attunement. If we don't aggressively dismantle these harmful structures, isn't Maturana's legitimate coexistence just a polite, comfortable cover for allowing structural violence to continue?
No, not at all.
I mean, we can sit around in a circle, deeply coexisting and understanding each other's fear, but until we rip the policies out of the employee handbook that are extracting life capacity, we aren't practicing wisdom, we are practicing complicity.
The implementation is absolutely necessary. I do not disagree with you there. The text is very clear that some practices just have to be stopped, cold, so that life can breathe again. But I warn heavily against doing it through the same kind of structural domination that created the problem in the first place. The paper introduces a critical principle here called non-forcing action.
I have to admit, non-forcing action sounds dangerously close to passivity. If a system is actively harming people, how do you fix it without forcing it to stop?
It isn't passivity at all. Non-forcing action means acting with the living structure of the situation rather than imposing an external, rigid order that violates it. Think about the concept of restorative margins.
Restorative margins.
Yeah. Margins are the physical and emotional space required for a living system to absorb a disturbance. It is the time, the safety, the trust, and the rest needed to heal. If you aggressively dismantle a hospital's protocols from the top down, even if you are doing it in the noble name of life value, without respecting the relational margins of the staff, you will cause a systemic collapse.
You're saying the cure might kill the patient if administered too violently?
Exactly. If you walk into a hospital that is already operating without any margins, where the nurses are barely holding it together, and you force a massive structural de-implementation protocol onto them, you are just replacing one form of control with another. A marginless institution cannot become wise because it is still forced into survival mode.
So how do you do it then?
The repair has to be relational. You have to align with the healing processes that are already present in the community. You have to ask the nurses what needs to be removed rather than dictating it from an audit. Structural dismantling that ignores the emotional and biological reality of the people inside the system is just another form of violence.
That is a compelling argument regarding human institutions. But have you considered how this framework holds up when we move outside of human biology? You are underestimating the scale at which misrelevance operates today, particularly in the realm of technology. Let's apply this debate to artificial intelligence and algorithmic capture.
Ah, synthetic misrelevance.
Yes. The white paper defines synthetic misrelevance as technology that is mathematically optimized for engagement over truth, attention over development, and extraction over life capacity.
Right. It is the technological amplification of whatever captures the nervous system, completely decoupled from any concern for what actually deserves our attention.
Exactly. And this, to me, is the ultimate proof that we need my approach, rigid cognitive structural guardrails. AI models and social media algorithms do not have biological sentience. They do not possess Catherine Pale Kaufman's viability sensing.
Obviously, yes, they don't have bodies.
A server farm does not feel grief or fear or love. Therefore, algorithms cannot participate in Maturana's relational emotioning. Because these systems completely lack embodiment, we have absolutely no choice but to manually encode the discernment test into their architecture.
But
we have to structurally force the AI to ask, does this optimized objective serve life capacity, or does it simply extract human attention to maximize ad revenue? The only defense against algorithmic capture is rigorous, top-down algorithmic auditing and structural constraint.
I see the logic there, but I think you are missing the primary battlefield. The greatest danger of AI isn't just a lack of encoded structural guardrails inside the machine's weights and biases. The real danger is the digital environment's direct, sustained assault on the developing human nervous system.
Assault is a strong word. What do you mean by that?
I mean that these platforms are designed to literally train the human body's salience toward outrage, comparison, and compulsion. You open a social feed, and it bypasses your cognitive spam filter entirely. It hits your brainstem. It hijacks your biological viability sensing.
Wow. Okay.
The platform trains your body to feel like you are in physical danger if you aren't constantly engaged in a cultural war. You cannot audit your way out of a compromised nervous system. The defense isn't just building a better algorithmic auditor in Silicon Valley. The defense is protecting our own biological margins, things like 8 hours of sleep, silence, unstructured play, and time spent in nature.
So your proposed solution to the existential threat of global AI algorithmic capture is what? Getting more sleep and taking a walk in the woods?
My solution is recognizing that if you do not protect the human organism's lived, embodied experience, no amount of AI regulation will matter. If a teenager's nervous system is chronically hijacked by a digital feed that makes them feel constantly isolated and anxious, their relevance realization is already corrupted.
Well, they're living in an emotional world of threat.
Exactly. If we want to survive synthetic misrelevance, we have to reattune to our own bodily viability sensing. We have to be able to feel the tension in our gut when an algorithm is trying to enrage us and actually have the physical margin to put the phone down. The human body is the final defense line against the machine.
That is a profound way to look at it, and honestly, it brings us perfectly to the synthesis of this entire framework. When we zoom out and look at Dr. Sali's life coherence wisdom compass as a whole, we see that both of our perspectives are actually structurally required for the model to work. The compass places life capacity right at the center, the protection, repair, and expansion of life.
Yes, and around that center, we absolutely need the embodied roots you've been arguing for. Emotion-sensing viability and relation-opening worlds of coexistence.
Transforming salience into insight. It needs the structural evaluation of the life value test, the anti-violence test, and the discernment test.
They balance each other.
Exactly. Without the cognitive tests I'm advocating for, emotion and relation can easily be captured by prejudice, tribalism, and historical trauma. We can feel very deeply about a sacred tradition, but if we don't apply the discernment test, that tradition can be weaponized to justify the exclusion or destruction of another group. The cognitive guardrails keep our emotions honest and tethered to actual life value.
And on the flip side, without the embodied roots of viability sensing and legitimate coexistence, your cognitive tests become sterile, bureaucratic weapons. We could build a perfectly logical, structurally sound system of de-implementation that looks immaculate on a spreadsheet, but completely fails to protect actual, breathing human beings because it completely ignored their exhaustion, their fear, and their need for restorative margins.
I think where we fundamentally converge today is on the text's central thesis. Wisdom acts by repair, not by domination. Whether we are trying to audit a massive systemic metric in a hospital or trying to heal a ruptured relationship in our own homes, the goal is to restore the conditions through which life can participate in its own flourishing.
We have to constantly ask two questions. What has been made to matter here, and what harm is being hidden by that frame?
Wisdom is the process of becoming less capturable by the things that do not serve life. It is life remembering how to let what truly matters matter again.
Beautifully said.
Let's bring it all the way back to that paralyzed pilot and the flashing cockpit we started with. The auditory alarms are blaring, the data is overwhelming, the screens are red, and the plane is hurtling forward through the dark. Dr. Sahali's white paper offers us a profound depth of insight for evaluating our own organism-niche relation in that exact moment of crisis.
It leaves us with a lingering, deeply personal question.
Yes. To save the plane, do you need to rewire the structural metrics of the warning lights on the dashboard? Or do you need to protect the biological margins of the pilot so they can actually sense which way is up? We'll leave it to you to decide.